I've had those psychiatrists say, you realize what you're getting into, you know, and I've given it a great deal of thought. And no surgery is to be taken lightly. There's always a possibility you might not even live through it, but that's rather slim. But
no, you're not worried, I take it, about having second thoughts or possible regrets once the operation is completed?
No, I'm really not, you know, and I've had that also called to my attention that I might have, but there's so many possibilities opening up there that...
Now, if you don't change your voice, as you mentioned, that you might not do, it would kind of be a giveaway in that sense upon meeting and speaking to anyone that you had certain male characteristics, namely your voice. Does that disturb you? I mean, is it something that you want known immediately upon meeting someone that you've had a sex change operation, or is that something that you'd prefer to save until later in kind of
I'd prefer to save that until later. I will take some voice training. And also I'd like some plastic surgery done on my face so I pass more easily, change the nose a bit and chin line and so forth. But those things are secondary to me, and I want to get the basic surgery done first. And
okay.
Not try to do it all at once.
Okay. I've been speaking with Roberta Dickinson, and Roberta, I want to thank you very much for being so candid with us and for sharing your experiences and thoughts with us.
Well, it's certainly my pleasure, Terry, and could I add something? I would just like to say that I hope that I'm sure there will be a few people in your audience, one or two, maybe more, parents who have transsexual children. And I hope that they will really help them enter transsexuality in a gracious way, because it is quite tough, particularly for young people.
Okay, thank you very much, Roberta Dickinson.
Thank you.
That interview was recorded with Roberta Dickinson in April of 1976. In the studio with me now are two doctors who are related to the transsexual operation, Dr. Terrence Malloy, who is a urologist, and Dr. James Guilfoyle, a psychiatrist. And before we go any further, I'd like to make a few explanations. One is that my two guests in the studio do not know Roberta Dickinson, nor does Roberta Dickinson know them. And I have not asked them here to comment on nor analyze what Roberta Dickinson has had to say. And nor have I aired her interview in the hopes that she will be speaking on behalf of any other transsexuals. It's a personal account, and I hope that it remains that way. Dr. Terrence Malloy is chief of urology at the Pennsylvania Hospital and associate professor of urology at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. James Guilfoyle is an associate member of the medical staff at the Institute of the Pennsylvania Hospital, a psychiatric physician at the Pennsylvania Hospital, and an instructor of psychiatry at the Hospital University of Pennsylvania. Now, I'd like you both to kind of outline for us your role and interactions in transsexual operations. Dr. Malloy, if we can start with you.
Well, I am a urologist primarily. This is my regular practice, but we have formed at the Pennsylvania Hospital a gender identity group, which certain surgeons will operate on proven transsexuals. This group consists of primarily myself as a urologist, and we do have a plastic surgeon that is in the group. However, our aspect of the group of gender identity is the last end of it. The most important end is the psychiatric screening and counseling, and the psychologist who administer the psychologic testing. As I've always said on speaking on transsexuals, the surgery is the end therapy, and it is only an end step. So that the first 95%, and to me the most important 95%, is what the psychiatrists send us. And any surgeon's results will only be as good as the psychiatrist who he has screening for him. And that's why I feel fortunate that the group of psychiatrists we have at the Pennsylvania Hospital have done an outstanding job on our group of patients.
So you will not see a patient and consider performing an operation until that patient has undergone a psychiatric screening process?
Absolutely not. In fact, many patients are sent to me from elsewhere in the state or in the country, and they will have letters from their psychiatrists or their family doctors or internists. And I always tell all these patients, although I respect their psychiatrist, I'm sure he is well-versed, I will not accept that letter. He has to be, my patients have to be screened by either Dr. James Morgan or Dr. Guilfoyle or Dr. Myers, one of the other psychiatrists in the group at Pennsylvania Hospital. I only have confidence in this group of men because I know how thorough they are in this, and I think they have screened more than 350 people, so-called transsexuals, in the last 8 years at Pennsylvania Hospital, and we've only operated on 23. So it shows a lot of people will come in saying, I'm a transsexual and I want sexual reassignment surgery, and they are not transsexuals. And the only way a surgeon could be protected is the group of psychiatrists that are doing the analysis, who are doing the screening, to protect him from operating on people that would be horrible candidates.
Dr. Guilfoyle, I expect that people come to you not to ask you if they are a transsexual, but to tell you that they are a transsexual, and in the hopes that you will kind of pass them in the screening process and therefore send them along for the operation. But it is your position to determine if they meet the standards that you have set for transsexuality. So I want to ask you if there's a kind of classic set of personality traits or history or background that you would define a transsexual by.
Yes, there is, Terry. I would say that transsexualism really exists on kind of a continuum, and like Terry implied, we feel that we get the best results with the people who are most at the transsexual end of that continuum, and along that continuum, all other sorts of aspects of sexual behavior and cross-dressing being one, effeminate homosexuality being another. Now, the classical transsexual is somebody, and I'll talk about the male who feels female and who requests to be transformed into a female. This is a fairly well-defined entity. He is someone who has felt feminine as far back as he can remember. His earliest memories are of feeling female. He's someone who is raised in a family whose father is usually distant or even absent. The mother has, in the cases that we've seen over a long period of time, the mother seems to have a very close relationship with the child that persists for many years, what we would call an extremely close relationship. And it's our feeling that this extremely close relationship promotes a female identity in the boy. That this, of course, gets into real questions about how all of us form our senses of sexual identity. But we feel that the male has a tougher time forming a sense of himself as a male than does a female forming a sense of herself as a female. And that the male has to is initially very closely involved with his mother, and in the process of forming his masculine identity has to, so to speak, disidentify with his mother and identify with his father. And this seems to be a process that gets aborted in the male-to-female transsexual. And there's some other things that we look for that in a male-to-female transsexual that go along with this. So we look for someone who usually has not been married or has not been able to experience intercourse, to have orgasms. This is obviously not a final criterion, because many of the transsexuals that we see have been married at times or have had intercourse and have had orgasms. But what we're looking for is someone who has really never seemed to attach any importance to his genitalia. And the male genitals are obviously an important part of a man's identity, his sexual identity. And if we find someone who seems to have attached some importance to his genitalia, well, we get a little suspicious, and we have to look at this person a little more closely before we'll decide whether or not to recommend surgery.
What is your role when someone who is seeking an operation comes to you? I mean, do you begin with the idea of doing your best to talk them out of it? Or are you initially a person who is very receptive and wants to hear everything that they have to say before giving any evaluation, if you know what I'm saying?
Right. Well, I behave with them just like I do with all my patients. I'm interested in what their problems are and how they see themselves. And I'm just like any other physician. I want to form a diagnosis, and I have to talk to them and interview them in depth before I come to any decision about what the problem is.
Now, the question, of course, comes up, who are you, or any doctor, or anybody outside of the person who seeks the operation, to say, no, you can't have it, if that person who seeks the operation is willing to take the risks involved, both physical and emotional, and willing to pay the necessary fees to get the operation?
Well, that's a very sticky question. I'm not a philosopher, but I can give you some kind of an answer. I'll try. I don't think anyone would say that this is not a problem, and it presents to a physician as a problem, just as somebody might come in and think that they have a sore throat and present to another physician. Now, if you came in to me and said that you had a sore throat and that you wanted to take penicillin for it, well, that's your diagnosis. Now, I have to consider this objectively and make my own diagnosis and decide on what's the appropriate treatment. You may have pneumonia, and if I treat you with what you want to be treated, you may die. So this is, so I have to make that decision. Now, there are other people say that who are we to stop somebody from committing suicide if they want to commit suicide? Now, people often do feel desperate, depressed, despairing at different times in their lives, and do feel that suicide is the only way out. However, I can't accept that. I have to try to save a life. And later on, what you see is that many people who've felt suicidal or have tried to kill themselves, they will feel very grateful and will not understand how they felt suicidal before. Other people, if I may get to one more example that other people often use, is the example of abortion. Abortion on demand has become something that's done fairly frequently lately, and people compare this to abortion on demand. Well, this is, I'm sure Terry will tell you, is not like doing abortions. This is not, if someone has an abortion, that does not mean that they cannot have children later. And this is this surgery is much more complicated and much more fraught with dangers, and is not a road that once traversed can be gone back over.
You made the analogy to pneumonia, and that if one doctor diagnoses you as having pneumonia and you indeed have a different problem, the medicine not only won't cure you, but it might have an adverse effect.
Mm-hmm.
And using that analogy, are you saying that if someone arrives to your office with a problem that you have not diagnosed as transsexualism but as something else, that having this operation might really ruin their life?
Oh, yes. That's why we screen so many people and give the operation to so few. People with all sorts of problems can present to us for a myriad of reasons requesting transsexual surgery because they've happened because of something they're going through at that particular time. They may feel that this is the solution to all their problems, and we have to be very careful about who gets this operation, because true transsexuals are really pretty rare. And sometimes people who are psychotic, people who are transvestites, people who are feminine homosexuals may, for various reasons, present as feeling themselves to be transsexuals. And we have to be very careful about who we give the operation to, because an effeminate homosexual and a transvestite is invested in his penis. And if he loses that, he's very liable to become profoundly depressed, perhaps psychotic. And needless to say, if someone has been psychotic beforehand with surgery of this magnitude, they may go psychotic again after the surgery.
Dr. Malloy, you are the urologist who performs operations. How well do you know a patient before they are on the operating table?
Well, the patients come from many areas, not only the Philadelphia yeast, as I said, they are sent in sometimes from other areas of the country because there are only a few areas that are now doing this surgery. By this, I mean respected areas. As I think Dr. Guilfoyle alluded to, there are many charlatans around that if somebody wants to plunk some money down the table, they can almost get a letter from their friendly pharmacist saying they're a transsexual and they'll get an operation. It'll be the wrong operation, and it could have serious adverse effects on them the rest of their life, quite obviously. But the respected centers, there are only a few that are doing this surgery. So once a patient is referred, as I previously stated, I send them to our gender identity group of psychiatrists for their impressions, their screening, and we repeat their psychological testing by our psychologist. If they're in agreement with the diagnosis that was made elsewhere, then I will talk to the patient, explain the dangers, the risks of the surgery, and then arrangements can be made for bringing them into the hospital. Once they're in the hospital, they have various medical tests, and we have further conversations with them about the magnitude of the undertaking they're going through, and we have to have them sign an extensive operative permit. And our friends in the legal profession would have us do this to every patient, but it is not what we consider in the best interest of a patient undergoing a major medical or major surgical procedure to have every complication in the world thrown in their face. But unfortunately, with the transsexuals, we have to do this because I consider this the final test. In this operative permit, it goes on for 3 pages, and my lawyer drew it up. In this, we warn them they might die with the anesthesia. The chances are very small, probably less than 1 in 1,000,000, but they could have an anesthetic complication. They could have a problem with their heart. They could have a cardiac arrest. They could have pneumonias postoperatively. They could get infected. They could have uncontrolled bleeding. We have not had any problems in the 23 cases that have been done of uncontrolled bleeding, but the next could be a problem because you're dealing in a very small area in the pelvis, which was not designed to have a vagina. And we were making a new vagina in the region between the rectum and the bladder and the prostate. There are major blood supply in this area, so it could get away from us where they could have significant blood loss. The other factors you have to explain to them is that you can't guarantee sexual function afterwards. If they don't follow our instructions, the vagina could shrink. This is not, again, a natural cavity, so they have to use artificial dilators and stents for many months after the surgery. In our patients, they have done well. Of the 22 female transsexuals, that is, males have been converted to females, 20 of the 22 are having active sexual intercourse and are having relatively few problems with it. The other two are not having intercourse because they have not yet found suitable candidates. They're still in their so-called virginal crisis. But for the most part, it's not been for lack of surgical results. But again, no surgeon will ever guarantee anything because there could be a complication on the next one we would do where we would not come up with a good vagina. So all these things are problems that have to be explained to the patient beforehand, and you have to impress upon them the irreversibility of this surgeon. They can take hormones and we can reverse it. In other words, they take hormones a year before we will operate on them. This causes breast development, will cause their testicles to atrophy a little, shrink, become smaller. However, if they change their mind or they decide they don't want to go ahead with the surgery, the breast development can be removed with a mastectomy. And although the testicles will never come back to their normal size, by giving them judicious use of male testosterone, their libido, their sex drive will come back, and they could go back to functioning as a normal male. However, once you have the surgery, they never again will have a penis, the normal male urethra. They won't be able to urinate as a male, and obviously they would not have testicles as a male. So this is the ultimate therapy, and this is why we have to impress upon them the finality of what they're undertaking.
So this these things that the patient has to sign and agree to, I get from what you're saying, are for two reasons. One is, of course, so that no malpractice suit is filed, but two is so this person who's undergoing this operation is fully aware of the possible dangers of the operation.
Yes, it's a test of their resolve, because I've had residents who have gone in with me while I explain this, and they have come out afterwards and said, I don't care if I had the worst cancer in the world, I wouldn't have an operation after what you told that patient, because you've listed every complication known to man, God, or beast. And this is what you have to do to really make them understand what a significant and serious step they're taking. We have never had a true transsexual or anyone balk at the operative permit because their desire is so strong. As far as the medical legal complications, I can still be sued for malpractice for this if I did not do the operation properly, if I was not judicious in my post-operative care. What this is the so-called informed consent, so that no one can ever say in a court of law that I didn't truly explain everything that could happen to this patient. So this is the item of the informed consent. It does not in any way free me from any dangers of malpractice because I am still bound to do my best and to use my best medical judgment in executing this surgery.
What kind of post-operative follow-up must the transsexual do after the operation is completed?
Well, after the surgery, which, again, I think in your tape, the patient you interviewed had alluded to somewhat, the penis is totally removed, the testicles are totally removed, and a vagina is fashioned and a new urethra. The urethra is the tube that brings urine from the bladder to the end of the penis. So you have to make this urethra much shorter. It has to be like a female's urethra, and it has to be put into the vagina in a new position. So all of these are new artificial space. To keep the vagina of adequate depth and length in the immediate postoperative period, this is packed with what we call a stent. It is really almost like a packing, which is like an artificial penis, to keep this a certain width and depth. This is kept in place for 5 days, and the patient has a catheter in the bladder for that period of time. At the end of the 5 or 6 days, they're taken back to the operating room. The stent is removed, the catheter is removed, and we check to make sure there's been no problems with any of the sutures coming apart, the stitches, or are there any problems with the surgery. At this point, the patient starts to urinate on their own and have normal bowel function. They have to keep a stent in there when they're not either soaking in the bathtub or in the process of going to the bathroom. This keeps the vagina at the proper depth and length, as I previously stated. They have to wear this really for at least 3 months. We prefer almost for 6 months. Usually in a period of 6 to 8 weeks, they can start to have intercourse if they're so inclined.
Now, do most of the patients who you've operated on follow through on all these necessary steps and see you regularly as they're
The vast majority, yes, and they see me for the first 3 to 6 months rather faithfully. It's a well-known fact in the transsexual's personality pattern that they are not the most reliable of patients. And although we do want to see them again for the rest of their life because we feel we have a commitment to these people and problems might develop in their vagina or in their urethra or in their prostate or rectum, we want to see them back at least at six-month intervals. But I would say of the patients I've operated on, probably no more than a third come back regularly after they get past 6 months in the postoperative period. Once they start doing well, once they are having normal intercourse and things are going well as far as they're concerned, they have a tendency to forget to come back and see you.
And that's, I suppose, very bad.
Well, we feel it's bad. We try to contact them. We send them letters, and they'll often talk to us on the phone. But as far as the actual coming back to the hospital, they are somewhat remiss at times.
Let me ask you both, this is part of your profession, this is, you know, performing and screening transsexuals. Do you have any moral judgments on it? I assume, of course, that you wouldn't be kind of morally opposed to an operation like this, or else you wouldn't be involved on it, but I do feel like I have to ask you that.
Well, the morality is something that every doctor that deals with transsexuals initially has to come to grips with himself. When I was first approached to do this surgery, I was asked if I would become part of this gender identity team and do the most crucial part of the surgery. I had to read extensively about transsexuals. I really knew very little about them at that time. And you have to do a lot of introspection into your own attitudes towards these people. But I feel that despite what my feelings are, this is the latter half of the 20th century. We have the surgical technique and abilities to help these people. And it is not up for me to make a moral judgment on another person's life. And if they are truly transsexuals, who am I to deny them the ability to have their life as they see it. And this is their whole problem. It's a crisis of gender identity. The gender means how a person perceives themselves. And these people feel, and they consistently say it, that they're trapped in the wrong body. So I think it's be very cruel of modern surgeons if they said, you're damned to the wrong body the rest of your life. And although we can remove this offending genitalia and make genitalia of the opposite sex, we will not do it. I am arbitrarily putting my set of values on them, which I don't think anyone has a right to do. So I have no trouble doing this morally, because I think I am being moral to the whole spirit of medicine and surgery, and that is to help people with their infirmities. Although this is a psychiatric problem, in other words, it has to be understood, these people are not hermaphrodites. They are normal XY chromosome males. There is no problem with them being normal males anatomically or physically. But because they have this psychiatric problem as perceiving themselves as the opposite sex, I would think it'd be remiss for modern medicine and surgery not to help these people.
Dr. Guilfoyle, can I get your reactions?
Well, I can't do much more than add to what Dr. Malloy has stated so eloquently. Of course, values do enter into psychotherapeutic treatment a good deal at various times, but I think we have to keep in mind that we are physicians also, and that my perspective on this is just like his, in that I view this as a problem, an infirmity that I as a physician have to treat in the best way possible, and that my own personal moral view should not interfere in my providing the best possible care and treatment I can to a patient.
As the transsexual operation is a fairly new medical development, as it becomes a not-so-new development, do you think there will be more doctors willing to perform the operation, and do you think that the screening procedures, you know, might change when that happens?
Well, I'm afraid so. It has become somewhat of a fad, I think, lately. At least it's written about quite a bit in the popular press, and as Terry said, there are a lot of charlatans that are getting involved in this field. I'm hopeful that we will be able to control this in some way, that the screening procedures will become no less rigid, if possible. We'll probably have better longitudinal studies and be able to do certain things and make certain decisions somewhat easier, but I still think that we should maintain a pretty rigid high standard that is maintained in several of the medical centers that are specializing in this area.
Do you have any feelings on press coverage of transsexuals? I'm thinking particularly of Renee Richards, who's the tennis player who recently had a sex change operation, and that's been making headlines for quite a while in the sports world and in the regular news world. Do you think that the way it's being handled, pointing to one person in particular and looking very closely at their case, can have positive or negative effects? What's your opinion on that?
Well, I think I have mixed feelings about it. I think it's good in some ways in that transsexuals are not as tormented as they were by societal attitudes, that the societal attitude toward transsexuals seems to be changing somewhat, and that some of them feel much freer in expressing this inner feeling that they have. On the other hand, it has made it somewhat difficult in our screening procedures to have so much exposure about transsexualism, because many people that we see who come in and who we later find out are not classic transsexuals come in with a pretty good knowledge of the medical literature and will answer our standard questions with the stock answer that we would find in a classic transsexual. So it makes our task that much more difficult.
How do you differentiate whether a response is really coming directly from the person, or, as you're suggesting, might be something that that they've read and are therefore giving you as the correct answer?
Well, I think there's a certain feeling that all of us are aware of when we deal with certain people, that perhaps we're being conned, and being a psychiatrist, I've been trained to be in tune to my intuitive sort of responses to people, and this is something that's very important in my work with these patients. And of course, the psychologicals are very important because one can often pick up inconsistencies if a patient is trying to create a certain impression. The psychologicals can be much better in picking that up.
I think it's important to have a team effect too. I think what you asked about earlier, this is not the work for the casual one patient that, say, one psychiatrist might see once every 6 years, and it's not for the casual surgeon. I think it should be, I am now seeing patients that are referred that had some part of the surgery done elsewhere, and I'm sure the doctor meant well that tried the surgery, but he wound up maybe not taking enough of the penis off, or they didn't make a vagina at all. There can be some very horrendous problems when people try this surgery that are really not well experienced in it. And I think the same thing happens with a psychiatrist. It's only when someone has a group effect and has screened many, many of these people that they become attuned to these prearranged answers that these people will come in with. And if they're seen by the psychologist, he draws his independent opinion. And then if several of the psychiatrists, if we have a question, the patient will be seen by several psychiatrists. And then if they program the same answer out to each one of them, it becomes apparent that they're spitting this out by rote more than really by heartfelt emotion. And this gives us a lot better idea on the problems we might be coming up with. But I think in its basic answer to your original question, this is not something that should be springing up at every hospital in the country to be doing transsexuals. I think it's, again, they're difficult problems, and we don't have all the answers even now, and it should only be done by people that have had experience, had the time, and are willing to put the time in and following these people for a certain period of time before they will approve them for the surgery.
Well, is there anything, do you think, that would be important to add at this point before we conclude the interview?
Well, I think it's a subject that it probably is being ballyhooed too much in the press at the present time. Renee Richards, again, I feel has been a positive and negative influence in that, number one, she is a physician, and by coming out with her story, it will help young transsexuals and people that are fighting this idea to know that they are not freaks, that there are other people that had these problems, and to seek reputable psychiatric and medical help for this. From that end, I think it has been a big asset. The unfortunate aspect of it, there'll be many people that are, as Dr. Guilfoyle alluded to, effeminate homosexuals, various schizophrenics, who in moments of despair or anxiety will say their whole problems could be solved by losing their genitalia and becoming a female. And this, of course, is going to be a big problem for the doctors trying to screen these people out. But any subject is better when it's out from underneath the table and people in the general community know that there are people with these problems. That gives them more understanding, and the people themselves with the problems in the community know they can go to various centers for help.
Okay, I'd like to thank you both very much for joining us this afternoon on Fresh Air. My guests have been Dr. Terrence Malloy, who's chief of urology at the Pennsylvania Hospital and associate professor of urology at the University of Pennsylvania, and Dr. James Guilfoyle, who is a psychiatrist and an associate member of the medical staff at the Institute of Pennsylvania Hospital and a psychiatric physician at the Pennsylvania Hospital and an instructor of psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you both very much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Fresh Air.